let's hit it.
And welcome to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. I'm your host, Lori LeBay, and I'm so excited that you're joining us today. We are going to have a fascinating conversation, as usual, as we learn from people all around the world at all ages and stages of life. Stay tuned as we shift our dementia care from crisis to comfort.
All right, here we go. What you think about?
Welcome back, everyone, to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio. If you missed our opening music, it's called Clarion Call by the Mark Arneson Band, and you can download that on any of your favorite music platforms. And it features Maya Dore, who just has an excellent voice. It's really uplifting music, and I find it a good way to start out my day. So feel free to check that out. For those of you that are new to Alzheimer's Speaks Radio, we're about sound information, not just sound bites. We want to hear the whole story of what's going on out there. And our goal is to raise voices big and small. So that means those that are diagnosed, those that care and serve for them, advocates, researchers, and so much more. We have had singers and songwriters and movie directors and authors, and the list goes on and on, to children who are getting out there and making a difference themselves. I also want to say thank you to our listeners. Because of you and your loyalty, you have spread basically our brand footprint all around the world. And because of your likes, your clicks, and shares, that I know you don't think mean much, they do. They are spreading the word and making it just easier for people to grab the information when they're ready, because we all have people in our spheres that are dealing with this, and many of them have never said a word to us, and they might be in our family, they might be our closest friends or neighbors. It doesn't make any difference, but we have to shift our dementia care culture so people feel comfortable. They feel like there's a sense of community and collaboration when they reach out. And to me, that's how we're going to win this battle against dementia. So I encourage you to continue clicking, liking, and sharing as far as wide as possible, because you are making a big difference in a lot of people's lives. Now, today we are going to learn about Harry's Haven and the Motion Picture Television Fund. You see, dementia doesn't care who you are. They don't care where you live. They don't care how much money you make or what you do. We are all dealing with this. But before I introduce you to our guests, I have to give a shout out first to the Memory Cafe directory. These are lifesavers. These groups, I don't even like to call them a support group because I think there's stigma that goes along with them. But they are for people with dementia and their care partners to give them a center base, give them that peer interaction. I say they're kind of like a bowling league or a bridge club. You don't show up for the equipment. You show up to have fun and be engaged and feel part of something bigger. And that's exactly what these do. So you can go to memorycafedirectory.com and find one near you. And if you have one, the listings are free. So again, go there and register. Reach out to Dave. He'd be more than glad to list you in the directory. I also want to remind people, we don't just do the radio show. We do a thing called Dementia Chats, where I facilitate a conversation with people living with dementia. And they tell us what they want in the world, how they want to be communicated with, what kind of services they have, what worries them, how can you ease the burden on their care partners and their families, and so much more. And those videos are all on our YouTube channel, along with something I just started this year called Dementia Quick Tips, which are things I wish somebody would have told me when I was on the journey with my own mom, who lived with dementia for 30 years. Now, one of our great partners out there is Coral Health, and they are offering, during this time of COVID, free apps for their Music First and Coral Faith. So just go to Coral Health And go ahead and Google them. You'll find that right on top. You can go ahead and download those apps. And it's just nice to have music and maybe some faith-based information as well on your phone. Just to bring some calm, bring some joy. And then last, I want to give a shout out to the Gain Alzheimer's Trial. People are always looking at ways that they can participate and improve, you know, what is going on. And the Gain Alzheimer's Trial is targeted to people 55 to 80 years old who are diagnosed with mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. And they have to have a care partner or family member that's willing to attend study visits and help with daily activities and prescriptions just to make sure that things are documented. And I lied. It wasn't my last thing. I forgot. This Thursday, I am doing a caregiver survival camp for Artist Senior Living in Yardley, Pennsylvania. Now, needless to say, I'm not flying there. So we're doing this virtual and anybody can attend. And you can register at 267-393-4454. That's 267-393-4454. Or you can just go to alzheimerspeaks.com and you can contact them via their website as well. So let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. I'm really excited. We were going to get together earlier and then COVID kind of threw us for a loop, which is kind of throwing everybody for a loop. So I want to first introduce Jessica Coy. And she is a licensed social worker, and she has worked with the Motion Picture and Television Fund community clients and residents with dementia for the last 13 years. Jessica is the director of campus and community-based social services. So welcome, Jessica. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Lori. Thank you very much for having me.
Great. And next, I want to introduce your sidekick, Linda Healy. She is a certified gerontological and palliative care nurse practitioner, and she has worked with MPTF residents with dementia for the last 20 years. And she is the director of both geriatric services and palliative care. So welcome, Linda.
Thank you, Lori.
Well, I'm excited. Linda and I have chatted on the phone multiple times trying to get this coordinated. And like I said, I'm so excited to have you both with us today. I always like to start out by asking our guests if they've been personally touched by dementia. So Linda, I'm going to throw that one to you first, if you don't mind.
Not within my own family, no. I hadn't had much personal experience prior to starting working with dementia 20 years ago. But of course, over the years, as a person gets older, there's been family friends that have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I've accompanied their families on their journey.
Okay, wonderful. Jessica, how about you? Have you been personally touched in your circle of family or friends?
Well, like Linda, no one in my family has been diagnosed or had dementia, but also like Linda, I've had friends who have had family members or parents who've been diagnosed with dementia. So kind of walked that journey with them as I've gotten, into it through my professional career.
Okay. Well, lucky you. My mom started in her mid-50s and lived till 86 with it. Wow. And the first 10 years, though, the doctors kept poo-pooing it to hormones. And my mom would go, "This ain't my girlfriend's hormones. we're talking. This is different, you know." And then by the time they truly tested her, they said she had the mentality of a 3-year-old and don't let her out of your sight. So it was quite a struggle. There, you know, wasn't much out there for support. And I know a lot of families feel the same way today, though there is a lot more out there than there was, 35 years ago. But we still have a long ways to go. So, Jessica, before we dive in, I want to kind of give our audience a big picture of, what the heck is the Motion Picture Television Fund? What are you all about and what do you do?
Yes. So we're actually about 100 years old, believe it or not. We were founded in 1921 by Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks, and Mary Pickford. And the idea around Motion Picture and Television Fund at the time was that people would actually donate their spare change in actual bucket on sets, where they would collect the money and help industry members who were in times of need. So this industry is very cyclical. Some people work a lot for a period of time and then they work no jobs at all. And so very early on they saw, you know, we have to take care of people in our industry if this is going to be successful, because to make movies and television, it takes all sorts of people and all sorts of jobs. And then flash forward about 20 more years, Gene Herschel bought our campus out here in Woodland Hills, California. We're on 48 acres of land. And I think the statistic was he bought it for $800 an acre, which is pretty incredible.
Especially for California.
Yeah. And here on our beautiful campus, we have a residential community, which can house about 160 residents in our assisted living facility. So that ranges from independent living to assisted living. And then we have Harry's Haven and our Mary Pickford House. Harry's Haven is our 40-bed secure dementia facility. And then Mary Pickford is our 40-bed long-term care facility. And we also have a 12-bed geropsych unit on our campus. And then we have a number of programs that take place off campus in our community, which I'll talk about a little later. But that's kind of the background of Motion Picture. Our mission is we support our entertainment community in living and aging well with dignity and purpose and in helping each other in times of need.
I love that. And I love the philosophy of just what our small change can do.
Yeah.
In terms of that big statement. And, you know, now there's a shortage of change because none of the banks, none of the banks want to take it in, you know, yeah. So people are hoarding it or else they have to pay to bring it in. And it's just, yeah. So what a cool idea, though. I love that sense of community and uplifting and knowing that we are all more than just ourselves, you know, and there's so much we can do together. I also am impressed that you guys have a geropsych area there, because that I don't care where you go in the country.
Yeah.
That is such a high level need.
Yeah.
And it's just not out there for people. And, you know, hopefully that is something that gets corrected, because, you know, families and healthcare professionals alike are really struggling with not getting proper diagnosis because there's no place to go that really understands,
yeah,
you know, what is happening there. So thanks for that background. That really, really helps a lot. Linda, I want to ask you, because I know you had a hand in creating your new unit for residents with dementia called the Harry's Haven. So tell us more about, you know, why you felt the need to even develop a dementia neighborhood or community or unit, whatever everyone calls it, different things out there, and how you wanted to serve them differently.
Well, Harry's Haven has its origins in the early 1990s, and was actually started by Kirk Douglas, gave us the real motivation and the funds to get something started. He had recognized the need from within his own circle of friends and people that he worked with, the need to support families that were supporting someone with dementia, that there needed to be some place and some way to give people a better quality of life and be able to keep a family as a family. And so that's where we started our original Harry's Haven. It was started in a building that today is close to 60 years old. It was a building that had been used for other purposes on campus. And so that's where we originally put Harry's Haven. Very institutional looking, in terms of long straight hallways that kind of dead ended at an outside door, which was secured so somebody couldn't exit. But within there, we really focused on creating programs and stimulation and joy and moments of, you know, wonder and discovery through different programs and techniques that we would hear about. We really kept up on what was happening in the dementia care community. So we were working with things like aromatherapy and memory therapy and incorporating exercise and light and those kinds of things into what we were doing in this old building. And we kept, you know, try and remodel and redecorate, but that was sort of it. So it was 30 people living in about 8,000 square feet. They all had a private room. Bathrooms were in the hallway, so they didn't have their own bathroom. But that was I can remember, I have some wonderful memories about that unit. You know, New Year's mornings, and the staff and the residents would all have pajama parties and watch the Rose Parade and drink hot cocoa. Looking, you know, watching that on the television, things like that. But anyway, fast forward for us, we had, because our Mary Pickford house used to be quite a bit larger, we had downsized a bit to be able to remain sustainable and be able to keep the organization what it is. And that had happened almost 11 years ago. So we had this space that was on the second floor above Mary Pickford House. And it's just under 23,000 square feet. And it was designed as part of the skilled nursing. So there are 24 private rooms, sorry. And then there's also 8 rooms that are two bedrooms. Quite a large space, very bright and airy, and it was just sitting there. And we kept trying to look at our old Harry's and how do we keep reinvigorating this? And the need is so great, and we only have 30 beds, and what do we do? And suddenly it was like the light bulb came on, and why don't we move them? And so that's what we started looking at doing and exploring, and like, how do we take all this programming we were working with and experimenting with and put it into this new environment and yet make it even better? So we were able to increase our census to 40. So by increasing from 30 to 40, about a 30% increase, we also went from 8,000 square feet to just under 23,000 square feet. So we went almost 3 times the size. So people had so much more elbow room. And this new unit really took off. So it's totally different in design. We really looked at literature and what's worked in other communities. Our CEO went to the Dementia Village in the Netherlands and was able to see that. And we were really in touch with leaders in this country, kind of looking at, you know, what's being done around the country that's been successful in dementia care. And so part of it, we were just really fortunate that the architecture and design of this second floor unit is actually like an oval track. And the rooms are all on the outside of the oval. So every room's bright and airy. They don't open up directly into a hallway. They open up into a little sitting area. So three or four rooms will open up into their own little sitting area. And then that just separated by like a little pony wall. And then you can see the rest of the space. So by having an oval, somebody can walk around and wander around this large space and not hit a dead end and not hit that frustration of there's nothing to do but turn around and go back the direction you just came. Building on that, we wanted to create a reason for somebody to move around the space. And so we created these little memory vignettes or memory stations. And there's 5 of them, and they define our 5 neighborhoods, because we were borrowing from the greenhouse philosophy and the philosophy from, there's a place in, I think it's in Wisconsin, and I'm trying to, it's Mother House or Mother House Memory Care, that they also used neighborhoods and such, as we were looking at all these different models. And so we have 5 neighborhoods in this large space. So that gives a person a sense not only to be able to explore, but also know where home is. They know where their room is and what neighborhood they live in. The 5 areas are a little market where there's actual food, produce, et cetera, that they're able to just take as they want to. Where they have a office with a typewriter and a filing system, et cetera. So somebody who just goes by there and feels like they want to sit down and do some work, they can do that. There's a workbench which has PVC pipes, wood things to work with, things to screw and unscrew. It's just something that somebody's going by and feels like they are compelled to work or want to work with their hands. It's there. There's a bus stop, and then there's a laundry room. So that there's things, there's socks to be sorted, there's towels to be folded. Again, it's just all just kind of sitting there. We always have a load of towels in the dryer. So if somebody walks by and just sees, oh, those, you know, I'm going to do this, that's what they do. So we made an environment that, unlike the old Harry's, we didn't have to bring somebody to an activity to stimulate them or engage them. We wanted to create an environment that, in addition to all our scheduled planned programming, the environment itself could just, you know, it'd be spontaneous. It would be something, you know, yeah, somebody could just go by and engage with these different sets and these different scenarios however they wanted to. And that was something that we thought would make it, life is about being spontaneous. And we thought that's what would give more opportunity for our residents. So that's in a very large nutshell.
I love, you said so many things in there. And I love that you explored and really, you know, went around the world to see what's going on out there. When you had mentioned one of your favorite moments is in the morning with the staff, with the PJs, you know, New Year's Day and things like that, it reminded me of the butterfly model. And I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but that is like nothing I've ever seen. And I haven't actually physically seen it. I've just seen this beautiful video about it where staff, you know, they wear their pajamas at nighttime, because it's a reality orientation. We're wondering why people don't want to go to sleep. Well, they don't think it's time to go to bed because there's people walking around like it's time to be up. Yeah. And so they really work on things on a whole different level when it comes to training and things. They don't do the typical training that we do here. And again, it would be difficult to do, but they do like a vulnerability training. And so they get everybody in a room and say, okay, you tell us your worst fear that you of anything you want anyone to know. This is what these people feel like when they're moved in. You know, they don't know who you are. They feel extremely vulnerable. And so they do this. It's just a whole different level of getting people to understand vulnerability and being scared and not trusting or the world not making sense. And, you know, they don't take staff breaks anymore because staff don't want them. They're just part of the family. And everything, I can send you a link to the video. It's just absolutely marvelous the way they have broken all the barriers. And some of the younger staff talk about it. I feel like these are, you know, this truly is my family. This is my extended family. They're like my grandparents to me, you know, and how mm-hmm. I'd want to treat them. And they eat their meals together. And you know, if somebody wants to go out, they go out, you know, just like you would at home. And so it's a pretty cool model. So I thought I'd mention that. I love all the memory stations. I think those are so powerful. And I like, especially for the men, that you worked in something that's safe, because a lot of times people are thinking power tools and all of those types of things. Like, well, not so much. You know? One question I wanted to ask was, do you guys have like a snoozelin room, or do you even know what that is? A snoozelin room is really a sensory room. Yeah. And they're real big. And I know some people will have bits and pieces, and others have actually set up separate rooms just for that. Have you looked into that or have that?
Yeah, I mean, that has come up in conversation with our planning. Currently in Harry's Haven, we do have some nice rooms. I don't know if it's the true definition of the snoozily room, but we have a small room that has this beautiful aquarium, and it's kind of a darker room. So the soothing view of the aquarium with the beautiful fish in it, kind of the bubbling water, is an area where we'll put some of our residents who we know would benefit from some, you know, downtime, just listening to some soothing sounds. And then within sort of the U shape, we have living room type areas with a fireplace, obviously electric. with some music and some couches. Again, kind of an area where people can come, chill out, visit with one another, and we have our resident birds. We have some birds in both living room areas, so people can sit next to the birds, listen to them, and then, you know, be amongst their friends with the fireplace. So those are some of the areas that we have, kind of in that idea, but not exactly like that.
And my guess would be that you have like a theater room, given your motion picture.
Yes.
Yes.
For that. And, you know, when it comes to Snoozlin' rooms, I mean, you can go all out or just add pieces here or there. I mean, I've had people say, you know, what can we do to improve? And they'll have this beautiful scenery and that'll be real quaint and maybe it'll be kind of cabin, you know, nature-y. And I'm like, you know, you've got room to add a picnic table in here mm-hmm. for people to sit. And you put some music on with some nature in the background, or you could even put in like a fake window that has a nature scene mm-hmm. behind it. I mean, there's it's endless. And then you add aromatherapy on top of it. And it's really cool how all that stuff can take off and really make a difference. I love the space that you have for everybody. That's mm-hmm. got to be wonderful for people not to feel so confined and trapped, because that, you know, makes people feel anxious, you know, period, with that. So thank you for sharing that. That's a really exciting what you guys have done. And I love that Kirk Douglas, you know, was one who really saw that need and said, you know, let's do something about this. Let's help people because it is such a need, and everybody has the power to make a difference in this. I'm a true believer. Right. I don't care who you are, what your status is. We all have that power of one to make the world a better place. We just have to speak up and we have to walk or talk, you know, with that. And that's very important. Let's talk next to Jessica. I'm going to point this one to you about how you serve people with dementia in the community mm-hmm. at large.
Yes. So we have a program called Elder Connection. It's not a dating service, even though everybody's great. That sounds like a dating service. and we have 5 social workers who work in that community-based program. And that program is divided by zip codes. And each of those social workers you could kind of think of as like a geriatric care management program. So they're assigned clients who live in the community based upon zip code, and it can either be industry members themselves or parents of industry members. And I would say the large majority of those clients either have Alzheimer's or have some, you know, mild to severe cognitive impairment. And so what those social workers are able to do pre-COVID is go out to the home. So oftentimes we'll get a phone call from an adult child or a family member, and they'll say, you know, I was just visiting mom and I'm really concerned because she's not acting herself. Or I've noticed that she's not able to manage the checkbook anymore, or is getting confused when she goes to the grocery store. And so our social workers will go out to the home and meet with the client themselves and hopefully a family member. And we're able to provide comprehensive assessments in the home just to kind of get a lay of the land as to what is actually going on. And then from there, we have our hands in many community resources and can link those clients to resources within their community. You know, if it's the Alzheimer's Association, or if it's an adult day program, or if it's really a situation where living at home is no longer feasible, then we'll help the family make that transition to a facility that will meet the needs of their loved one. So that might be here, or it might be a place closer to a child because it's important for that child to be near their parent to take care of them. Another great service that we have is here on the Motion Picture campus is an outpatient medical clinic called AgeWell. And we have two geriatric practitioners. And oftentimes we'll bring those community clients in from the community where we really want to learn more about what's actually happening here. And so those clients will come in and we'll go through an assessment called a comprehensive geriatric assessment, where they will meet with a social worker who will do the memory screenings, the comprehensive psychosocial, and then they'll meet with the geriatrician who will then do the medical piece. And at the end of the visit, which usually takes about 4 hours, because we also have a physical therapy and occupational therapy component to that, the family and the client will walk away with kind of a care plan, for lack of a better word, with, you know, what does the doctor and social worker see going on for them now? What are some things they can do post-visit to follow up on those concerns? And then how can we address these concerns going forward with them living in the community? I think some of the other things we've been able to do for community members is we've had some evidence-based classes that we've held both here on campus in our satellite office in Burbank, Powerful Tools for Caregiver program, a memory training program. And, you know, so we're always really trying to stay on the cusp of what do our clients in the community need and how can we address those, both on an individual level and then, you know, kind of more on a global level through the classes and such. So that's what we're doing currently with our community clients who are living with dementia.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions for you. One, a lot of people don't know what a geriatric manager is. So if you can just define that term, because a lot of people just don't have a clue.
Yeah, so a geriatric manager is somebody who comes in and kind of looks at the person holistically. So, you know, a client has been referred to me, I'll go out into the home and I'll look at them holistically. I'll look at their home environment. Is it safe for them? I'll look at their physical needs. I will look at their medical needs, and then we'll look at their financial needs. And you're kind of looking at the person as a whole person, and where are things kind of falling through the cracks? And how, as a manager, if you think of the word manager, how can I help them manage this? How can I help guide them, this either this person or this family, to services that are going to shore up some of these holes or things that they're struggling in their life? And then we follow them. So we don't just come in, you know, give them X, Y, and Z, but we'll come in, we'll give our recommendations of where we see they might need help and listen to them in terms of where they need help, and then help walk hand in hand with them this journey to a point, hopefully, where they feel safer and more contained. And we just really kind of manage them and their life as much as they'll let us to a place where, they feel a little bit safer and where life's a little bit more manageable. Does that?
Yep. No, that makes sense. And do you do that just with members of the entertainment community, or is it open to anybody?
So yeah, we do it for members of the entertainment community, and we do it for parents of people in the entertainment community. We do have an eligibility process, and I'm not going to bore you with all the details of that. But to get certain services, they need to have worked in the industry a certain number of years, and to live on campus, they would have had to have worked in the industry 20 years. That's kind of the magic number. In terms of eligibility. But to answer your question, yes, it's industry members and parents of industry members that we provide the geriatric care management program to.
So are there like fees or a sliding scale for services, or is it just?
No, it's part of the charity.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing, really.
It's very amazing. Yeah. It's very amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible, actually. Yeah. So there's no fees or attached to the service. You know, one of the programs that Linda runs is the palliative care program. And oftentimes Elder Connection and palliative care will partner together in terms of managing somebody both through their, if it's dementia, and then, their health situation and palliative care, that service through motion picture also is part of the charity. But Linda can speak more to that because that's her baby.
Wow. Well, why don't we roll over to that right now? That's I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, okay. So palliative care is the care, support, and focus on quality of life and symptom management for somebody dealing with a serious illness. And it doesn't have to be terminal. They don't have to have a prognosis of less than 6 months. It can be somebody who's going through a serious cancer treatment for which their prognosis is expected to be pretty good once they come out the other side of it. But in the meantime, they're having to do a bunch of treatments, or it can be something more chronic and progressive like dementia or like lung disease or a heart disease that's really reaching a stage where it's impacting the life. It recognizes, again, that holistic thing. We're not just our diagnosis. You know, we have families we worry about. We have finances we worry about. We have, you know, all these other things that we worry about when a diagnosis kind of derails our life. And so palliative care is delivered as a team. It's that we treat the medical component, whatever medically is going on with this person, to make them as comfortable as they can, to support whatever other treatments they're having. If they're going through chemotherapy or radiation therapy, then we're coming along and partnering with that, with the oncologist, to make sure the symptoms are being controlled while they're doing their treatment. In the case of dementia, we're working with the geriatrician or the neurologist or whoever is kind of treating the dementia itself. And then we're helping to support to make sure that the person, again, their quality of life is as good as it can be, that we're working with the social workers in that case, and then also the family, because the family needs so much support. So we have the medical piece. We also have a social worker in palliative care. We have a chaplain that's in palliative care, and just to make sure that we're, and nursing, and we're to wrap this person in a layer of services. For MPTF, we're providing the nursing component, a coordinator, a chaplain, and a social worker, and none of that comes at a charge. The physician part of it is through their insurance, and so we don't collect anything for that. We partner with them very closely right now with UCLA and their palliative care certified physicians to be able to provide that piece, but we all work together as a team. So it's really looking, and that's why our focus is on industry members, because this whole organization is supported by donations from industry members to support industry entertainment industry members. So, you know, that's our mission, that's who we serve, and then we don't charge for our services.
Wow, that is just so amazing that you guys have pulled this together and it's sustainable. I mean, I'd love to see more industries take a stand and get involved and, you know, because we're not doing a great job out there as a whole, in my opinion, from a healthcare standpoint, in terms of meeting the needs of so many families out there. And,
right.
And that is just so critically important. And it takes people to get creative and really listen to people. And really take in what is going on. And I know that's what motivated me to step out of. I was in residential real estate working with the senior market for 25 years. Never thought I'd leave it. And then it was actually the senior housing that said, you know, you got to tell your story. You've found joy. You know, you've found a way to live graciously alongside this. People need that. There's such great fear. And I love talking with other people and being able to raise their voices and let people know this can be done. And it can be done in a lot of different creative ways. There's no right or wrong way, you know, to approach this. The only wrong way is to do nothing, mm-hmm. is to just let it continue. Mm-hmm. And you know, to me, that's where things really, really can fall down. I think it's about consciously caring, you know, and getting that support to them in ways that matter. Mm-hmm. And so kudos to you guys. I think there's also so much misunderstanding about palliative care and hospice. Mm-hmm. You know, we have such great fear of end of life, and, you know, it's really about smart living, and people need to understand, you know, you want support throughout your life. You know, we have this falsehood that we should all be independent and we shouldn't need any help. And yet, you know, who do we value most? Our family and our friends. That's not being apart. That's not being alone. That is being connected and being supported in other ways. And so we really have to help people reframe what support is. And, you know, I have one program I call that's called Family by Choice. You know, it's really about being one big extended family, and both staff and family members need to understand how that works and what each other's roles are, because there's so much misinterpretation out there in terms of expectations and what's really going on. And, you know, I'm sure you guys even see that, where families might, at first, maybe when somebody moves in, they're looking for trouble. They're looking for all the problems. And so, and the staff is like running and hiding, going, I can't talk to him again on this. They're just going to yell at me. And what people don't understand is why families do that.
Yeah.
And why staff reacts that way, and vice versa, and being able to have those conversations and just say, until we build trust, you know, we're not going to have this raving fan or this great family by choice, you know, team working together. And, you know, we're scared for our loved ones because it's a change. We're feeling guilty. You know, all of those things are going through our head. And so we've been taught that we have to fix things. And so you can't fix things if you don't identify them. So that better be my job.
Yeah.
Is to look for what's not working. And then and then that's all we focus on, is what's not working. We're not focusing on the good things. So having communities and staff that understand it's important to not just call us when a med gets screwed up or somebody fell or something's missing, but to send us a picture of somebody smiling or a little video, someone giggling, or a project, or there's so many different ways we have to connect that say we understand, we care, and this is, you know, this is what we are, what our goal is, you know, is to get these true feelings. And I think so often, again, people get scared by words, palliative care, hospice, dementia care, I mean, any of it. And, you know, dementia is just another illness that we have to deal with, just like we've dealt with AIDS and cancer and heart disease. And, you know, it's about learning to be gracious and realizing that there is support and we shouldn't be pushing it away. It's there for a reason. It's been developed because there is a need, and there shouldn't be any shame in that. You know, that's about really living as a full engaged society, and is a beautiful, beautiful thing. I wanted to also ask you guys about COVID, because COVID is like, you know, taken the bag and dumped it upside down in everybody's life. If they never left their home to begin with, or not, or if they were traveling around the world. You know, if they're living in community, everything has changed. So I'm assuming for you guys, you've seen some effects with that as well. And my guess is you probably both have some comments on how COVID has impacted your community. And Jessica, I'm going to go to you first on this one, just because I went to Linda last time regarding the palliative care, but how has COVID, you know, affected not only your residents, but your families and your staff as well?
It's, it's been a huge upheaval in the lives of everybody, both our staff, our families, our residents. And I'm going to let Linda talk about, you know, COVID and the unit that we had here on campus, because we did have some positive COVID cases, and, you know, the work that she did around that, because really she was boots on the ground here taking care of those residents. But, you know, in terms of our larger community, in our residential community, we have seen, you know, a bit of a decline in some of our residents, who are kind of used to getting out and being social, and, you know, family members definitely being worried about their loved ones. You know, we're blessed to have a rich social service department. And so You know, not only do we have nursing staff in our residential community, but we have social service staff. And so from the very get-go, we started reaching out telephonically to families, letting them know kind of what was happening here on campus, trying to address their concerns, connecting them with their loved ones here on campus, either through the phone or through an iPad, doing FaceTime, doing regular updates about what was happening on campus as it related to COVID. We have our own internal television. It's called Channel 22. It's run by a woman named Jen Clymer and our residents. And Jen, to answer the question of COVID, the way that she wanted to engage our residents and keep them active is she started a program called Organized Chaos. And so for a couple days a week, she would be on the television having residents call in and start to interact with them on the TV, but also on the phone, and had different guest speakers come in. And she continues to do that today. Both Linda and I have been on Channel 22 just to talk about things that are happening across campus. We've done programming on Zoom with the residents, different game shows. Social workers are checking in with them daily to make sure that their care needs are being addressed from an emotional level. And then in the community, kind of the same thing, trying telephonically to reach out to people, make sure they feel supported, connecting them with either online or telephonic services that can keep them engaged and decrease, you know, that self-isolation and loneliness. We have a great program called the Daily Call Sheet, which is a telephone reassurance program where we match volunteers with people in the community that might want a phone call every day just to chat. I mean, that's as basic as that. So we have our volunteers calling industry members in the community and just having telephone chats with them. And like I said, it could be daily, it could be weekly, whatever the person feels like they need. And then we're doing support groups. So our social workers are having Zoom support groups for the families of industry members that live here on campus. Anne Front, who's the palliative care social worker, continues her support group via Zoom for the caregivers. And then we've attempted, haven't been so successful yet, as doing a support group for the residents. That's a little bit technology related rather than lack of interest. So we're continuing to try and get that off the ground. But yeah, I mean, I think that the self-isolation, the loneliness, those are some of the things that we're really seeing people struggle with, and just, you know, every day trying to think of new ways to reach both our clients and make sure our residents' needs are getting addressed. And I think overall, we've done a beautiful job with that.
Wonderful. Linda, why don't we talk a little bit more about Harry's Haven and some of the experience you've had with COVID there?
Yeah, so Harry's Haven, clearly the programming has had to change because we can't bring people together like in a larger group activity, et cetera. The staff is still wearing PPE, so it's been since mid-March since the residents have really seen the lower half of the staff's face. But they're recognizing us by our voices and by, you know, our mannerisms and things. So we're able to keep some familiarity, though it was disorienting in the beginning. And as we put people, we closed the campus March 9th in anticipation of the build of COVID in the Los Angeles area. And knowing that that was happening, we just shut down visitation. We put the staff in masks. We, you know, tried to keep this an island of safety. And March 30th is when we found out that we actually had COVID on campus, and it was in Mary Pickford House. But over the next 2 weeks, both Harry's Haven and Mary Pickford had cases. We ended up with 17 total. It's been 14 plus weeks since we've had a new case. So we're
on wood.
Got a lid on it, knock on wood, all that. But during that time, for the month of April and into May, we had, again, it's a large campus, and we've been around for so many years. There's nooks and crannies that used to have a purpose, and then that purpose went away, and they just could have stood because we couldn't figure out what to do with them. We used to have a little medical surgical hospital on campus. And we were able to take that and turn that very quickly into our COVID isolation unit so that when someone did come up positive during that two-week intense period in April, we were able to move them away from everybody else and put them into this isolation unit where they had a dedicated nursing staff, et cetera. That had its own challenges because we had some of our people, they are like from Harry's Haven, they weren't particularly symptomatic. They couldn't be out with everybody else because they did have active COVID, but they were also feeling well enough that they wanted to get up and walk around and wander around and walk out to see what the nurses were doing. And so you can't just take somebody like that and say, well, go sit in your room, because that's not going to work. It's just, and it's not good for them. And so we had to get really creative. How do we engage these people that really need to stay away from everybody, but be able to get them out, like to get outside and get some fresh air and go for a walk with somebody who's heavily garbed in PPE and you know, and be able to do those things and be able to make their days just not one monotonous thing after another. There had to be those moments of joy in the day. We did all facilitated a lot of FaceTime visits with their families. So, you know, we'd get people outside in the fresh air and then they could sit there with the iPad and somebody helping them and talk to their family members, and that helped. Upstairs on Harry's, again, things had shut down, and we haven't really been able to open up fully like we would like to be able to get some of our services back in, like Urban Zen, which was a combination of Reiki and aromatherapy and a one-to-one session with guided breathing. And that was a really successful program, but we haven't been able to bring that back yet because we're still being super cautious about who comes on campus and how many people we let on campus. But we are, thankfully, because we had moved Harry's just a few months before, we're able to utilize the space that we have to bring small group, like two or three people together with somebody, or let people move a little bit around and engage with the environment. So that's helped a lot. Massive testing. We struggled in the very beginning of April to get access to testing supplies, much like everybody else in the country. And finally have used some of the donations that have been made specifically to us for this purpose to get some on-campus testing equipment that we're able to now get results in really real time. And we're doing a lot of surveillance testing to make sure like all the residents on campus gets tested monthly. All the staff that has direct contact with those residents, we're testing twice monthly. We're just really trying to keep this, you know, okay, we've been through the storm. J Wing, which was our little hospital unit, is closed. It has no customers right now. And we're hoping to keep it that way. But anyway, it's been a disruption just like it has for everywhere else. And we're just kind of feeling our way through it and trying to connect families with each other, you know, those that live on campus with those that don't, as best as we can.
Yeah, we've had, you know, I've talked with communities all around the world, but you know, some in memory care have literally even taken all their furnishings out of common areas. So if somebody does wander, they can't sit. But that's got to be awfully frightening too, yeah. Because then what's happening and are we moving and, you know, that's just got to, you know, not be a good thing either. It's hard. And then there's others that have smaller wings and they're still getting together in their smaller groups, you know, of maybe 10 to 14 people in a wing and doing activities. And they've been good about not having spread either. So, I mean, there's just so many different ways to approach this. And, you know, it's nice that you guys have your own TV channel, because I know some people are bringing in like exercise programs, or you could even do the breathing program, I suppose, you know, on there and try different things. But again, it's plugging everybody in and, you know, trying to get families comfortable too, if they're not allowed to visit and having those connections. I've got one gentleman in one of my memory cafes, and he's pretty techie. So he bought an iPad for his wife's room and they have it set up there and he can bop in on her at any time. It doesn't ring, it doesn't ding. So it's nothing that's going to scare her. He can observe her, or he can call out and talk to her and see if she'll engage. But it's not, you know, it isn't staff heavy in terms of needing to do anything other than just set it up once. And mm-hmm. that has worked really, really well. And he just appreciates being able to peek in and see that she's okay, even if she can't talk. And it's a real gift when she does choose to have a conversation, you know, with him and things. So there's, you know, we're learning so much about relationships and how to engage and different alternatives and things. You know, we've seen the ones where they have the hug walls, you know, with the arms that go through and things like that. That has to be hard to clean those things up.
Our response.
Yeah, we talked about that here and we were like, we're not so sure about that one, but nice idea. Not sure how clean.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of endless out there. Well, I'm glad that, you know, you've got the COVID under control, because I, you know, we all hear on the news how it's spiking out there again in California. And, but again, I would imagine hopefully more people have respect for it since you've been through this now, you know, a couple of times. And I know in Minnesota, it seems like people are getting a little bit more lax, you know, and we're hanging tight there, but you know, it just feels like it's a matter of time if people don't really take this thing seriously and monitor how they're interacting with people and the whole PPE thing. How are you? I have talked with a lot of people that are really scared that if it hits again, there's going to be a shortage once again in terms of PPE. And I just read an article today saying some people have ordered PPE, and it says that it's federally approved, but it's fraudulent and it's not the quality. And it's just like, oh, criminals, come on, put your mind to good use and stop scamming everybody. No. But is that a worry for you guys out there?
Well, it's always a concern. We do track our burn rate for PPE. How many are we going through now? We were tracking how many we were going through in terms of gowns and masks and gloves and goggles and all that when we had J-Wing open and active cases. So we have a good idea of what our burn rate, current burn rate, would go up to if we had to reopen J-Wing again. Our purchasing department worked around the clock. I mean, they have since this all started, constantly going back and trying to find sources of quality, you know, PPE that we can use. So right now we're in, you know, again, knock on wood that nothing dramatically changes. We've got, I think we're about 3 weeks ahead in our supplies and constantly exploring, renewing that. So we're able to at least say, okay, if something happened tomorrow, we're not going to be caught with nothing to use. And we'll have a few weeks to get, you know, make sure that we are able to amp up our supply. But that's taken a lot of work and a lot of exploring all kinds of clues. So, you know, we have a lot of very helpful folks that would call in and say, oh, my cousin lives here and they know so-and-so and they'll get you something. And, you know, that's just how you have to run down every lead. And it turns out the cousin didn't know so-and-so and there is nothing to be gotten, but we got through that.
Yeah. I have a couple of friends who are on kind of like sewing bees, and they've been sewing gowns and stuff for different communities. One's in Minnesota, another one's in Colorado, and you know, they're getting the right material, same with masks. And I was visiting one of my friends here in Minnesota, and I mean, they had a room and they just had bins full of stuff. Just like, we don't need it right now, but we don't know if we're going to be able to get it. And, you know, and so my one friend, she used to do a placement for like 55 of their communities. And she's like, I'm just running around to Michael's and Joanne Fabrics, you know, grabbing stuff and then getting the supplies out to people. But you know, they're looking at different ways because they don't know what to expect, you know, with everything. I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time today, but I do have one last question, and that is, what's the future for the Motion Picture and Television Fund? You guys, I'm sure, have some things on the list that you're dreaming about implementing. And Jessica, I'll go to you first on that, and then Linda will go to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the community, our Elder Connection Program, you know, we're only going to see an increasing need for care managers to be out in the community working with clients and families and educating. And, you know, so my hope for the future is that we continue to expand that here for our industry members, you know, not just in California, but across the country. We are able to work with people, again, it's kind of telephonically, that live in New York, but to be able to offer them support and a connection, not just to help, but to their industry. And so I just hope we can continue to expand that and get the word out that we are here and able to help. And then, you know, I think on campus, expanding, growing larger in terms of our ability to house people who have dementia in an appropriate setting where their care needs are being taken care of, not just physically, but emotionally and for their activities and their interests. I know that there's future planning to build here on campus, kind of a new community, more state of the art than we currently have, where we can increase our census and bring more people in who need that level of care.
Yeah, there's some really neat communities out there that have really done a lot with technology. I have a friend over in Australia, and they have sensors throughout their whole building. Mm-hmm. And so they can see where somebody is just by the floor sensors. They don't have to worry about them getting on an elevator and going to the wrong floor because their pendant that they'll wear or their wristband won't allow that. It just won't open for them.
Wow.
And they've done some really cool stuff for, I mean, even just getting supplies into a room instead of being invasive and just walking in. They have a two-way cabinet, so they can put them in there, and then only one person, when they go in to visit, instead of all these people in and out, will just undo the supplies and unpack them. I mean, some really simple things. Lights that are under... sensor lights that are under like a nightstand, so when someone gets out of bed it just goes on. You know, magnet doors so people don't necessarily know something opens. The list is just phenomenal of what is out there and what can be done from a safety and comfort. You know, it really is so incredible. Or even just the little MP3 players that people are using for personalized music and things. And again, you guys are doing a lot of neat stuff with the holistic approach, which I think is so, so important out there. Linda, what do you have to add about the future of the organization and what you'd like to see?
We turn 100, as Jessica said, next year. So we're looking to go another 100 beyond that and just keep meeting the needs of industry members. I mean, one of the things that Mary Pickford, one of her big quotes to us when she was talking about founding this organization was, we see a need and we fill it. And that's really, I just see us continuing. So I can't, you know, whatever direction we go on is going to be in response to what we see the people that we serve need. For myself and like palliative care, I think the one thing that came from COVID was that we made a transition into virtual visits that we had been tiptoeing around but weren't quite sure how to address. And so by doing that, we've been able to serve people who geographically haven't been able to get to us to actually meet face to face. And now we're having these relationships and these meetings and these office visits with them all virtually. And that's been really helpful. It's also allowed us to partner with physicians that weren't within our immediate network, but are part of that person's care. So we're able to have our chaplain and social worker become a part of that team. And so I see more of that happening, even when it does become safe eventually to go back into a doctor's office. We've been forced to grow, but it's been a fortunate growth because we hadn't quite figured out before how to serve these people that just couldn't get to us.
Yeah, there was such a pushback on telehealth. And now, I mean, there's a cost savings. You have the whole germ thing, you know. I mean, there's just so many levels to it. And for palliative and hospice. And Linda, I believe I shared this story with you. When my mom was actively dying, and actually before, she started coming to me in dreams. And she had told me that I wasn't going to be there when she passed. And I'm like, but I'm the person. That's me. That's my role. I'm always here to help people transition. And she just said, no, I need you gone. I need the others to experience the death process. So when my mom died, I actually was doing two keynotes out in Arizona. My family, other than my daughter, thought I was having a nervous breakdown because why would I leave? Didn't make any sense. But I knew that that was her wish. She wanted me to carry on my work and she wanted them to be more involved. And so I was thinking that I would just partake by phone. And my daughter said, well, how about if we FaceTime? And so we FaceTimed. And this was like, oh, she died in 6 years ago. And so here I am down in baggage claim waiting for my for my luggage. And I'm FaceTiming with my mom. And at the time, my daughter's saying, I think this is it. Do you want to say goodbye again? And so that just started a whole new scenario in terms of communication. She didn't pass away at that time. And I was able to talk with her and be part of the family experience. They're all packed in the room. And, you know, I have one brother that needs to be put in his place every now and then, and no one would do it. And I could do that by video. And then they broke out laughing and the tension was cut. And, you know, I could guide them on how to care for her without physically doing it by, you know, getting, if it was cool washcloths or swabs or ice chips or whatever. I was able to participate in the last rites. I was able to see her take her last breath. I mean, I didn't miss a beat, even though I was traveling. And I firmly believe she had a plan for everybody I met. It was just like the perfect person my whole trip. It was incredible. But I never envisioned that even being possible. And I questioned how much I'd really get out of the phone calls, but I knew this was my mother's wish and I was going to hold on to it. And I, you know, I am such a huge advocate of, you know, these teleconferences and people, you know, people used to poo-poo support groups too, you know, on Facebook, people would, you know, chat in back and forth and message and post, and people would say, you know, those aren't real friendships. Those are deep friendships because they're talking about real things that actually mean something, not the weather, not sports, not politics, you know, but stuff that is really meaningful in their everyday life. And, you know, we can't under appreciate and underutilize those things when they're right at our hands. You know, our relationships are so deep. And there's just so many different ways to communicate. And, you know, like with a Zoom, I mean, people can go ahead and record those and have those after, you know, even if someone passes. Or maybe they get healthier, but it's a reminder, you know, that we have those. I have some music therapy ones of my mom that I can have the worst day of my life, and I go watch a 3-minute video of my mom in her end stages, joyful, singing what she can, falling asleep, but hands are flapping and toes are wiggling and she's smiling and giggling, and that can make my worst day a great day. You know, so we need to tap into new things. We have to not be afraid of change. And, you know, one of my favorite questions that I ask myself, on a much more serious basis, due to all of my dealings with dementia, is what's the lesson? There is a lesson in everything. And I loved the quote, when we see a need, we fill it. Because if we ask, a lot of times we're spinning as family members or staff in a scenario and we think we're looking for the answer, but we're really not. We're just swimming through the minutiae. But when we stop, and sometimes we have to stop and even get angry. I've gone down in my basement when no one's home and screamed, "What's the lesson?" You know? But it makes me centered and really focused on what's important. Mm-hmm. And I always find the answers. I mean, they just come, and because I wasn't truly looking, I wasn't open enough, open-minded enough, you know, because I thought I knew how it should be, what the answer should be. And a lot of times we don't know what these answers are, you know, and so we have to be open to trying them and seeing what's there. I'm excited for you guys. I can't imagine the celebration you'll have for your 100th year. How fun is that going to be? The different ways you come up to support one another. If there's a way I can ever help you, just, you know, please reach out. I would love to be of assistance in any fashion. Now, people listening may want to get a hold of you. And so what is the best way to contact you? You've got a website. Mm-hmm. And so, Jessica, do you want to give us that website?
Sure. It's www.mptf.com. And then for anybody listening who might be an industry member themselves, we also have a phone number to call, our intake line, which is area code 323-634-3866. So that's 323-634-3866. And just know that that actually is a message line. So you'll leave your name and contact information and any questions you might have about services, and a social worker will call you back.
Wonderful. And then if they are interested in emailing you, Jessica, is that, can they go ahead and do that?
Of course. So my email is Jessica, J-E-S-S-I-C-A .caugh.ey @mptf.com.
Wonderful. And then Linda, is it okay to give out an email for you as well?
Absolutely. It's Linda, L-I-N-D-A .healy, H-E-A-L-Y @mptf, Mary Paul Tom Frank .com.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you ladies so much for being with us. In wrapping up, I just want to remind people you can always go to alzheimerspeaks.com. Two S's in the middle there and one at the end for more information and resources regarding projects and initiatives that we have. And in the future, look for a new program that I'm launching called Conscious Caring Support. It's going to be specializing in transforming caring transitions for family members and those with dementia. I think it's really important to assist people. I've heard more and more people wanting support. And so it will be kind of a combination of a mentoring coach program, as well as some group programming that we can do as well to connect people and really evaluate where they're at and how they can work through this. How can they live graciously alongside dementia and not look at it as a travesty, but really find the gifts that are wrapped in there. And there are many. I bear witness to that. I lived with it for 30 years. And I still say to this day, my mom's disease is the biggest gift I'll ever receive. Wouldn't wish it on anybody. But there are some really great life lessons to be learned. And, wonderful people that you will meet along this journey. So again, thank you everyone so much for your support of Alzheimer Speaks, and Linda and Jessica, and to the Motion Picture and Television Fund, thank you so much for what you're doing. It's absolutely phenomenal, and I wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you for having us.